he saw my Instagram, saw all of the homes that I had worked on, and he said, I'm really afraid for you to come to my house. And when I saw his house, I said, you should be afraid. You should be very afraid.
Welcome to Milton & King's On the Wall podcast, where we engage in conversations with artists, designers, and more. Today we speak with Los Angeles-based interior designer Sarah Ron of Sarah Ron Design. We hope you enjoy this conversation. If you do, please subscribe and consider leaving us a rating and review. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm well.
Now tell me, is it Sarah Ron or Ran?
Ron.
Ron, okay, that's what I thought. It sounds like it's spelled, okay.
Exactly.
Perfect. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's cloudy and gray here in Los Angeles, which never makes me happy. I moved to LA for the sun, so when it's gray.
Oh, did you? Where did you move from?
I grew up in Ohio, so I fled there fairly quickly. I lived in North Carolina for a bit, but I've been in Los Angeles primarily for almost 20 years.
Oh, okay.
And so a long time.
Did you move straight to the LA area or did you kind of hop around in Southern California?
No, straight to LA. And I have moved all around Los Angeles over the past many years, but I'm now raising I have a blended family, so we are raising our 5 kids in the Palisades, which is a great place for kids.
It's a very nice area.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's great for the kids.
What was it like growing up in Ohio?
As my children like to say, I had a white picket fence childhood. very, you know, Mayberry-like. We didn't lock our doors. I rode my bike everywhere. I had a lot of freedom. And, you know, it was a very small town, Main Street, America, which was a wonderful childhood. A wonderful place to grow up. I always felt safe and, you know, was able to be independent, which I think is harder for kids these days to have that independence.
Yeah. How many siblings did you have?
Just one. I had a younger sister, and so it's just the two of us.
Okay.
And now, like I said, I have between my husband and I, we have 5. So it's a very full life.
Yeah, definitely.
Also running my own design firm on top of being a mom of 5. So,
right.
Yes.
And that's Sarah Ron Designs, right?
Yes.
Now, did you, I don't know what age you were when you came out to Los Angeles, but were you doing design stuff when you were still in Ohio?
No. So before I actually started in interior design, I was a professional race car driver.
A professional race car driver?
Yes.
No way.
Yes.
That sounds awesome.
It was. I started when I was 10 and just doing essentially go-karts and then kind of worked my way up, which is why I lived in Indianapolis and then I lived in Charlotte and then I ended up moving to LA, retiring, having a family. And then that was when I went into interior design. I started actually as an art director out here for the home renovation shows.
Yeah.
So I started doing that. And then I did staging for a bit. And then I worked for a couple of design firms and then decided to do my own. So
just going back, because that just sort of blew me away, but going back to this racing thing.
Yes.
How many years did you do that for?
20 years. I started when I was 10.
20 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. And what got you into that?
My family. So my grandfather, I'm not that old, so I wasn't around in the 50s when he was a race car driver, but my father was. And so it was just kind of always in my family. And when I was 8, my dad took me to a race, which I fell in love with. The race track and the type of cars. They were open wheel cars that he took me to watch and I just fell in love with it. And so, you know, he loves to tell the story that it took, you know, 2 years for me to convince him that, you know, I wanted to do that and not be like all the other little girls who were taking dance classes and, you know, gymnastics. And, you know, I was also very girly. So I think he just really didn't think that it would be something that I actually wanted to do, that it was more of an idea than something I wanted to do. So it took me 2 years. Yeah. And then he finally, he let me practice in a friend of his son was racing. And so they let me go to a race and drive and be in a race one weekend. And, I finished third in my first race, and like everything was borrowed. I didn't have my own helmet. I had nothing of my own, and I finished third. And so my dad thought, oh, well, maybe she is serious about this. So wow. Yeah. So then we bought my first race car when I was 10 for $500.
So did you get into like not only racing it, but did you know how to work on the car? And you kind of, I mean, I imagine racing a car, you're getting into everything about it, right?
All the mechanics at a certain level. Then when you get to a certain professional level, you really have nothing to do with the car. You have a crew and an engineer and a team and all of that surrounding you. So you don't. So yes, there was a phase of my life where I was intimately involved. It was my dad and I doing all of the work on our cars, you know, and doing it out of our garage at home. But then when you get to a certain level, you're just beyond that, where you need people who do this, mm-hmm. that their full-time job is taking care of your car. At that point, you're going so fast. I mean, your speed's at, you know, 190, 200 miles an hour, like, I'm not working on the car.
From what I can tell, even though you're sitting in a car and the car's, you know, doing a lot of the work, you're still at the end of it. You're exhausted, right? Like it's the intensity and what you're paying attention to, like would drain you by the end of every race. Is that
well,
right?
Well, I think you have like that adrenaline high at first, you know, when you're finished, like you're still coming off of all the adrenaline. Mm-hmm. That's been pumping through your body. But yeah, I mean, by the time you get into bed that night, you're spent and you sleep very well. And you have to be in really good shape. I mean, I worked out, I did yoga, I did Pilates. I mean, with lifted weights, you have to be really physically fit to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Crazy. Yeah. And so that, that obviously brought you out of Ohio. And like you said, you were going to different places for the races, I assume, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was traveling all over the world. I went all over
really?
The country. Oh yeah. I went to Australia. So yeah, I was, you know, doing a lot of traveling during those years.
How cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so, did sort of the passion for it die, or was it just like time to do something else? What made you transition away from that?
I decided I wanted to have a family, and I was 30 years old, and you know, I'd been doing it for 20 years, and I just knew that if I, you know, I lost my mom when I was young, younger. And mm-hmm. so I just knew when I made that decision to become a mom that I wasn't going to race, because I knew I wouldn't be able to do it at the level I was doing it and still and be a present parent and not have in the back of my mind like what might be happening to me, what might happen to me with my children, you know, things like that. Like I didn't want my mm-hmm. kids to be ever thinking, oh my gosh, like is mom gonna be okay? Or just even putting myself in danger intentionally, you know, like there's one thing, yes, like any number of things could happen to us on any given day, but there's a difference between knowingly putting yourself in the environment day in, day out that, you know, the odds are eventually something's going to happen.
Had you ever had any bad experiences or wrecks or anything like that?
Oh, for sure. And I lost several friends over the 20 years. I mean, no. I had many friends die. I had many friends, you know, suffer from the multiple concussion syndrome. One was paralyzed. I mean, it's not a joke.
Yeah.
It's a serious business. So,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, honestly, for me, I'm lucky. I don't really, I mean, I have an achy shoulder from an IndyCar accident, but, you know, other than that, I have, you know, all of my faculties. I don't have multiple concussion syndrome. I'm really lucky to have done what I did for as long as I did with the minimal things happening that they did.
Do you still watch it or?
Never.
Never. Okay.
Never. It's too hard. You know, it's just because you still want to do it. It's still in your blood. I think when you leave, for me at least, it's like I watch it and I just want to be doing it. I'm not a good spectator. I'm a doer, which is probably what makes me good at my career now. Like, I'm a doer. I like to get in there. I don't like to just watch people so do things.
Do you actively avoid watching it? Like, you're
no,
like,
I mean, if it was on, I wouldn't be like, no, turn it off. But it's just not something. And quite honestly, like, living in Southern California, racing is not a really big thing. I mean, I think if I lived in Indianapolis or Charlotte or one of these other racing towns, it might be different. But, you know, it's not really that popular or prevalent here. You know, I was in Indianapolis, 2 months ago, two or three in October for my niece's baptism. And, you know, someone recognized me when I was leaving a breakfast place. You know, that never happens in Los Angeles unless they recognize me from being on Selling Sunset. Like, no one here recognizes me as a race car driver.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
And so moving away from that, how do you make that transition? Like, what do you just decide when, like, throughout, let's say towards the tail end of your racing career, are you getting interested in interior design? Or
so
what's happening in your life that makes you transition?
So I grew up, I wanted to go to art school. You know, I loved art. I loved architecture. You know, one of my first jobs was working for the city, painting murals on buildings and, you know, revitalizing the city.
So you did mural work?
Yeah. So okay. I was always interested in art. You know, when I was in college, I asked my parents if I could switch and go into design. And, you know, my parents were very Midwestern and they said, you know, smart kids don't go to art school. Smart kids don't get design degrees. Smart kids, you know, they become lawyers and doctors. So, and I was racing. And so, you know, at that time, then I thought, okay, my backup plan, if racing doesn't pan out, well, I'll go to law school. So I got a business degree, which was like the most creative thing I could do. And then, you know, obviously have never used my marketing degree and I went straight into racing for a team. So I really didn't use anything I learned in college. Although I think having a business degree, running my own business has been really helpful. But other than that, no. I mean, I took art classes for all of my electives. I grew up taking art classes. There was the small town I grew up in Ohio was next to a city that had a pretty large museum and they had a lot of art classes. So I would take those on the weekends when I could. You know, I took ceramics classes. I took glass blowing classes. So it's just always been something that I've loved. And then when I decided to quit racing, I knew I wanted to do something creative.
Hmm. Now, just a question about the mural making. Do you know if by any chance, because I know it's sometimes it's rare because things always get replaced and painted over, but do you know if there's any murals that you've done that are still up?
I have no idea. I could probably ask some of my friends who still live there, but I don't know.
That would be cool.
That's a good question. It would be cool. It's been, 30 plus years. So
yeah, you just never know. Sometimes, you know, new things get put over them and that kind of thing, but sometimes they last and it'd be cool to know if, you know, something you created on the side of some building or whatever it is still there.
Yes, that would be cool. That's a good question. I should ask. My children would probably love to see it too.
And so you come out to LA for interior design?
I came out here to just move to LA. Then I started working, like I said, as the in the art direction and mm-hmm. for a show, for a home renovation show. And I just started as an assistant. I was the assistant to the art director.
And how do you land that?
I knew I had a friend who worked for the network. And so she was like, just, you know, send me your resume, send me what you've done. Because over the years, I had also, as I was racing, as I was moving around, I had always renovated my condo, my home that I lived in. So, mm-hmm. and I was, over the years, I would refinish furniture. I would find things. My mom was a big antiquer. So we'd go, I'd find something, I'd buy it for, you know, $20, like a dresser, you know, and then I would rehab it. I'd refinish it, or I would paint it, or I would, you know, I'd change the hardware and I would make it look, you know, refurbished, and then I would sell it.
Now, where did you get those skills? Where did that come from?
Just like self-taught. I mean, okay. Just like trial and error, you mm-hmm. know, like, oh, okay, well, I tried this paint and this doesn't look great. You know, it was really just sort of from my art classes, from the things that I knew and the things that I read, and, you know, I'd get books from the library and how to refinish something. I would go talk to the guys at the hardware store, you know, things like that. And I'd find, you know, because my mom was always antiquing, I would find really cool things. Like, I'd find cool hardware that I could put on something else. And
and you were doing this while you were racing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was just like a hobby. You know, yeah. I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It's the same. Like, I also love to cook. So it's relaxing. For me, yeah. being creative is therapeutic. It's the absolute best part of my job is the creative side. So that's kind of how I basically, you know, made a portfolio with the things that I had done of my own personal projects. They hired me as the assistant to the art director. And then, you know, we were one episode in and the art director essentially had a meltdown and left and went home.
Oh, no.
And so the person...
And the door opens for you?
The person running the show said, hey, you've basically been doing it all of this anyways. Do you want to try his job? And I, of course, said yes. So I took over. I finished all the episodes on the show. And then just as sort of everything in my life, just worked my way up, you know?
Now, are you allowed to say what show that is, or do you want to?
I don't know if I can, so I won't.
Okay. This is good to be cautious.
Exactly.
I guess.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I mean, it's been a long time, but you never know.
Yeah. Right. And then, so what happens from there? Like,
so then,
do other jobs come because of that show?
Yeah. So then I ended up, I started having children. So I had my two kiddos. So I took some time off and then went to work for a big staging company here in LA and did that for
staging houses.
Yes. And I was mm-hmm. doing all of these giant houses. I started again, kind of the same thing. Like, I started doing little condos, and within a couple of months I was doing, you know, 15,000 square foot homes, like all the celebrity homes. And I cannot say, but I have been in, I can't even tell you how many celebrity homes that I staged.
Now you go from doing condos to these bigger homes all mm-hmm. within the one company?
Yes.
Okay. So they sort of introduce you into the higher end.
Well, I started, you develop relationships. So I started doing these little condos and the realtors were saying, you know, you've done a better job than the designers doing my celebrity houses. So that they would start requesting me. So I became really popular doing the staging with all the realtors and the builders and the developers. And so those then, when I decided to do my own firm, those became my referral source. All of the builders and the realtors that I worked with who loved my work would send me clients. So that was sort of the way, you know, and it was, it took several builders telling me, hey, you should start your own firm. Like, you're really talented. You should not be working for other people. And so I eventually, you know, took the leap and started just working for myself. And I haven't looked back. When did that start? That was, I started dabbling in doing my own stuff about 5 years ago. And then I'd say 3.5 years ago was when I fully decided, okay, I'm doing my own thing.
Now, was there something you were doing when you were staging these homes that that was different or unique, or something that you, like, either a philosophy or something that you were using that was obviously putting you head and shoulders above the other people doing it, to where people were telling you you should go out on your own? Like, what were you doing different, do you think?
So I think for me, one of the other designers said to me that, you know, when he stages a house, he's like, you can tell I've done it. And he said, but the way you do it, he said, I can see your soul. Like, you're so creative. You can see your soul in every house you stage. Like, it has a life. And I think a lot of staging doesn't. It's lifeless. It's like you walk in, there's no personality. It's just, you know, it looks like a corporate housing kind of thing. And I think I put a lot of effort into the layering and the extra pieces. It's not just about filling a room with furniture, right? It's about making it feel like a home, making it feel like someplace you want to be. And I think that is the difference. I think, and I'm also, I'm sure every client of mine will tell you, I am a perfectionist. So for me, I would stay after everyone would leave, just making sure that every single thing was up to my standards. And I think a lot of people don't do that. You know, they're like, eh, it's good enough. Like the 80-20 rule, like it's 80% of the way there. We're good. But when you go the extra 20%, especially in design, like the devil is in the details, right?
Right.
It's the little things that make a big difference.
Now, how do you decide when it's done? Is it just, there's nothing eating at you? There's nothing saying, oh, this isn't right?
Yeah, I think it's just looking at it and, you know, it's a feeling. Like, you know. So I worked for another design firm that I had a lot of junior designers underneath me. And I was in charge of training them. I also trained designers at the staging company. And I really think there were a lot of young women who came to me and said, you know, how did you learn this? Or how did you get so good at this? Or how do you know? And I think, you know, you could go, I've had junior designers who've gone to like the top design schools, the best art schools. They have wonderful educations, but I think there's something to be said, like, you either have an eye for it or you don't. And that can't be taught. You can't teach that you can't train in that. It's just a feeling. It's something creative inside of you that can't, it doesn't translate into a lesson or a textbook. You know what I'm saying?
When you're staging at home, are you essentially trying to make it seem lived in?
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, you can't, there's a fine line. So private design is totally different. Like, we are customizing everything to a family or to a couple or an individual or whatever. That's different. When you're staging, you have to keep it somewhat impersonal because you don't want to make it so tailored to a look that not everyone can like it. You know, it's a very different beast, staging and private design.
Right, because you want to make it seem lived in, but you don't want to steer it so much towards something to where it might, someone who's looking at the
house.
And
they think, oh, well, this isn't my style. Exactly. Everyone has to be able to see themselves in it, you know, with a few tweaks. Of course, not everyone's going to love every piece of furniture, but you need to walk in. It needs to feel inviting and it needs to feel warm without being, you know, tailored in a certain direction. Like, you don't want to be too modern. You don't want to be too traditional. And it depends on the house. I mean, if it's a sleek, you know, Hollywood Hills house, that's totally different than a house in the Palisades. You know, you have to know mm-hmm. your market as well.
Now, when it comes to staging, mm-hmm. Not everybody knows exactly how it works. Mm-hmm. When you're doing this, is this all stuff that's sort of on loan and then it just gets returned, or how does the staging?
Yes. Yeah, so you know, essentially, like, as a designer, you would go, you would pick so let's say I'm doing, you know, a 10,000 square foot house in the Hollywood Hills. I would go to the house, I would see the house, and then I would make a list of everything I think I need to bring to the house. I mean, down to like what you're putting in the bathrooms, like on the counters, what you're putting on the dining table. Every piece of art. So you bring in truckloads of furniture and art and pillows and bedding and anything you can imagine to live in a house without living in it, other than your personal effects. And then you start, you know, placing it in the rooms.
Yeah. And then, so are there companies that loan out for that specific purpose?
Yes. So they charge a fee. They charge a rental fee for the stuff. And the realtor or the builder or the homeowner would pay the rental fee for all the furniture. Mm-hmm. And then when the house sells, you know, sometimes, actually frequently, people would just buy the house with the staged furniture because they said, oh, this looks great. Like, I don't have to bring anything. Right. I'll just move in.
Does that happen? Does that happen a lot?
You know, that it does happen quite frequently. Yeah, it does. Yeah. Or especially certain rooms, like, you know, let's keep the family room and the, you know, the main rooms, and then we'll bring our bedroom furniture, like, have that be more personalized.
Right. Interesting. And so when they buy it with all the stage furniture in there, that cost is sort of factored into.
Well, no, it's a separate cost because they would have to pay the staging company for the furniture. Mm. They wouldn't pay the owner.
Oh, okay.
So it's a separate fee. Yeah. And it can be really expensive to buy. But we're talking in Los Angeles, these are very high-end clients. These are not people who are budgeting to save up to buy furniture. I mean, they're buying mm-hmm. very expensive homes.
Right. And so what sort of angle? I mean, I imagine there's things you probably love about both things, but is there mm-hmm. one where that you enjoy more in terms of staging versus, you know, full on interior mm-hmm. design and styling for a client?
So there are two things. Like, I would say my preference is definitely private design. I love the relationships that I build with my clients. On Saturday, my husband and I are going out to dinner with a previous client of mine and her husband. You know, I love the relationships. I love the personalization. I love getting to know people's, you know, their quirks, the things they must have. You know, everybody is so, we're all so different, the human experience, right? And I think that's really a wonderful part about private design and working with people. It's like just getting to know them. And
it does get so personal, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you become like a family member because you're in their home. You're helping them build their home. You're helping them choose. Right now I'm working on a house with clients with two little girls, and you know, this is going to be their family home. This is the home that they're going to stay in until their girls go to college. So it is very personal, and I love that part about it. And you know, for me, one of the things I always say, like, my job as a designer is to take, you know, what you're imagining in your mind and bring it to life and make it better. Like, and so how cool is that? I mean, that's a really cool job.
Yeah.
And then I would say the one thing that I do love about staging is just how fast it is. You walk the house, you see the house, you have the vision, you do it in a couple of days and it's done. Like the completion of it, the satisfaction of just like, wow, that looks amazing. I did that in 3 days. That right. part is really fun too.
Of course, staging, I assume, would have limitations in terms of what you can do, right? You're not doing any renovating type work,
no.
right?
It well, would all sometimes, just be cosmetic, you know, maybe? Sometimes it depends. Like, you know, if I saw a house and it was really dark inside or something, I might tell the realtor, look, like, let's paint the house on the inside to brighten it up before we stage it. You know, there were things like that. Sometimes we would do painting or removing of things, but no, not like a full on renovation. No, you're not doing that with staging.
But you find that doing private styling and private interior design work does give you the freedom to make those sorts of suggestions, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, we're changing. In most projects, we're changing everything. We're either doing a new build or we're completely renovating the house, you know. So that's where every little detail is important and thought about and considered.
How many projects are you working on at any one time?
I have 6 projects right now.
And is that the typical workload for any?
Yeah, I mean, it ebbs and flows. Like sometimes if I finish some projects, I might have 3 or 4 and then another project starts up. But I usually never have less than 3 going at one time.
What's sort of the typical timeline that you try to stay within, or can they just be open-ended?
It depends on what we're doing. Like I had a project in Calabasas that took, 2 years because we started, you know, at the beginning of the whole, we took the whole house down to the studs, redid the exterior, the backyard, the whole house, reconfigured it. And we were waiting on windows for a long time. They were back ordered. So that delayed the project. So, I mean, that took redoing the whole house down to doing all the furniture and everything, it took almost 2 years.
Wow.
But normally, like I'm working on a project right now in Malibu. We started in December and we're doing a full renovation and we're supposed to be done in March.
Okay.
So, you know, it really varies.
Yeah. And so you had mentioned that you were in that Selling Sunset show.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that, are you like a regularly recurring person that's going?
No.
Okay.
No. I was working on a house that was featured in the show a couple of seasons ago. So I was on that episode. But other than that, no, I am not a Selling Sunset star. And
no, I didn't mean like one of the stars on it, but I just meant like, are you someone that currently gets brought in like either by the Oppenheimer group to do things or?
No, not anymore. When I was working for the staging company, there were many episodes that featured homes that I had staged, but I don't stage at all anymore. I just don't do it because I'm too busy with my own firm. So I don't do anything anymore with that.
Gotcha. So Milton & King being a wallpaper company, I do have to ask, when I see a lot of the, especially the higher end homes, I find that wallpaper is not really very prevalent in a lot of the homes. It's just a lot of, you know, white walls, maybe a couple of art features and stuff. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, again, it's for resale. You know, they don't want to have the house be so personal that people don't like it. So I have, I'm sure you've seen my website and my Instagram. I have a very kind of specific style that people hire me for, but I myself am much more artistic. So I have, you know, the mixtapes wallpaper that you guys have.
Yep.
I have that. That's in my son's bedroom. I did it on one wall in his bedroom. It's adorable. And, you know, as a kid who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I showed it to him as like, we need to do this in your room.
And he's like, Mom, what are these?
He did, but then, so we then, I bought him a, you know, a boom box that he can also connect his phone.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, out of the five kids, his room, he gave me carte blanche in his room. He's like, Mom, I trust you. You do what you want. You know what to do.
Wow, so that's some confidence.
Yes. So out of the five kids, his room, they're all like, his room is so much better than mine. I said, yes, because he gave me creative license. If you give me creative license, you too can have a room that looks like that.
How cool. So now you're telling the other kids, see?
Yes.
Mom knows what she's doing.
Yes. But so getting back to what you're saying about not seeing wallpaper in these homes, especially on TV. So in my powder bath, I put a graffiti wallpaper up.
Oh, cool.
And it looks like street art in our powder bath. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many people, you know, my husband's a lawyer, we host here a lot, and everyone has a mixed review. Like, some people come out of the bathroom, we had hosted a holiday party, and I'd say 90% of the people at the holiday party came out of the bathroom, and they were like, that is amazing. That is so cool. So artistic. We love that, you know. And then there were a couple people who were like, I'm not sure what to think about that, you know, because it is a statement, right? And it's art. I mean, I made the bathroom is to me a piece of art, and I love it because it's true to me. It's true to who I am. It's true to, you know, my artistic nature and my love of art and my husband's love of art. And so for us in our home, it's amazing. But I would never put that in a house that I was doing for a builder who's trying to sell it to the masses.
Right.
You know? And so I think wallpaper becomes just very a personal thing. I'm working on a house in Grand Cayman right now, and we're doing a wall, like this beautiful floral wallpaper mural in their daughter's bedroom, you know? But again, that's for a private client. You just don't really see that in the houses that the builders are building. And that's what is generally on these shows. It's like they're trying to sell to the masses.
Are, aside from just on the shows, but I mean, generally speaking, a lot of sort of the higher end homes, I mean, obviously, I'm not seeing everybody's home, but just generally speaking, I kind of just see a lot of the just sort of the plain white kind of very neutral look.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, is that just because of, is it just because they're maybe likely just investment properties and they're not really putting too much of their heart in it? Or
a lot of them are. And I also think that, you know, look, for the last many years, that's really all anyone wanted was neutral. I think that we're heading away from that. I think that a lot of my clients I'm working with right now, they want a little bit more color, and they're going away from the all white walls. And I think, you know, I think there's something to be said for, I'm not a big color person, like I would never recommend getting a colored, you know, a sofa or a large piece of furniture in a bright color. That's just not my thing. And most of my clients do hire me for my use of neutrals, but being able to bring it to life with neutrals, that's also a skill. Like, you have to be able to layer and texture and, you know, do different woods and things like that to still make it look warm and inviting when you're trying to use all neutrals. But, you know, I am seeing more and more that clients are, you know, wanting to use green or blue or just having some pops of life in their home, which I think is a refreshing change from all of the neutrals.
Have you ever worked with a client that's just a total maximalist fiend that just wants you to go crazy, or is it all?
Yes, that would be my husband. He's my worst client. I'm like a minimalist and he is a maximalist. So when we first met and started dating, he saw my Instagram, saw all of the homes that I had worked on, and he said, "I'm really afraid for you to come to my house." And when I saw his house, I said, "You should be afraid. You should be very afraid." So, but most people that hire me, you know, like I said, they hire me for my aesthetic. So No, I don't really get any clients who say, "Let's go crazy. Let's do all this," because They have sought me out based on my work that is out there. So they know kind of what they're getting.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
How did you find, you know, you transitioned from, you know, staging into more of your private interior design work. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But what comes along with that also is, you know, it's not just you being creative, it's you're running a business.
Yes.
And so I assume, do you have employees, you have help?
So I have an assistant. It's myself and one assistant, but I do all the creative.
Yeah.
So, but she manages the deliveries and the scheduling of the deliveries and the orders and the invoices and the business side. When I first started, it was just me and I was doing everything. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point where I just couldn't do everything. I was too busy. I had too many projects. And so I was nervous. I think whenever you're starting out, it's scary to take on an employee and like, oh gosh, am I going to be able to pay this person? How long am I going to employ this person? But she's been with me now for over 2 years. And she's great. I love her. We, you know, she now knows me well enough to know a lot of the answers that I'm going to give that she doesn't have to ask me. You know, when the clients might ask a question or, so that's really been wonderful, and not having to do the administrative keeps me being able to be facing with the, you know, client facing, going to all my meetings. Like before I hopped on the podcast, I was across town in West Hollywood meeting with clients all morning. So, you know, she manages so many things for me to be able to do that and be creative, which is such a blessing.
Do you also find that it allows you to stay in that creative zone? Because like I noticed that it takes, you know, it takes a different part of your brain. And sometimes it's hard to get into the groove of being creative if you've got your math head on. You know what I mean?
Definitely. And I, you know, there are still times that I need to look at things on the business side. I try to block those out in days so that I'm not going from that and then trying to be creative because that is really hard.
Yeah.
And once I get into a creative zone, I don't want to get out of it. Like I want to be where I am because I am in a creative zone and I want to keep that flowing. So I do generally, and she and I will talk, I'll say, okay, like in the morning, you know, Monday and Tuesday, let's just knock out all of these administrative things. So then I don't have to worry about it the rest of the week.
In terms of, you know, kind of just staying on the cusp of style and trends and that sort of thing, where do you find inspiration? So are you always just sort of trusting your gut and however you feel at the moment or when you're talking with the client and you just go with your gut kind of thing? Or are you always looking for kind of the next thing or inspiration or, you know what I mean? Like, are you trying to stay on top of what's happening now type of thing?
I mean, I think it's hard not to stay on top of what's happening now. As designers, we are inundated with, I mean, if I showed you my email inbox of all the companies who are, you know, sending me their information, sending me their products. Like, I think it's kind of hard not to be on top of what's happening because you are just sort of inundated with it. I think for me, one of the things that is important to me, I was actually talking about this with clients the other day. I don't ever want a house that I do to be too trendy because you don't want it to feel dated. You want it to feel like it could be beautiful today or 10 years from now. And I think you want your clients to be able to live in their homes for a long period of time and not feel like, oh God, I bought this in 2023. And so mm-hmm. I think there's like a curation that, yeah, you can have some trendy pieces that are easily swapped out, right? Like you could have, for me, I always tell clients if they want something trendy, like do it in the accessories and buy them from, you know, CB2 or something like that where they're not expensive. It's not a big investment. And when you're sick of it, you can swap it out for something that's trendy then. I don't like to go with like, I know everyone is big with boucle right now and every piece of furniture is being made in boucle. And for me, it's like, okay, if you really love boucle, let's do one piece of furniture in boucle. Let's do a chair or a pouf or something. But like, don't do a giant sofa in boucle. Don't do your dining room chairs in boucle because 2 years from now, that is going to be out of style because it's mm-hmm. everywhere now. And anytime something like that happens, it's going to hit the wall where it's just, like, you're going to look at it and say, oh yeah, we bought that in 2022, those boucle dining chairs. Right. So for me, yes, the trends are the trends, but I also think it's true. You need to follow what you like, what you love. If you really love something, it really doesn't matter if it's trendy or not.
Where do you find, that you get most of your inspiration from? Are you paying attention to other interior designers? Are you traveling to other countries and getting inspiration? Where do you go to light that fire?
I do love, for me, traveling is so inspiring. And I'm sure if you see my Instagram, like one of the builders I work with, he said, sometimes I think your Instagram looks like a travel, not an interior design. Because I mm-hmm. do love traveling and it is inspiring. You see the way people mix things together. You see something, a color combination that inspires you. You see, you know, I was at, in August, I was in Southern Italy and there we were in this tiny town where they had converted a castle into a hotel, but it had like maybe 4 or 5 hotel rooms. But what they had done was really incredible. They kept the existing castle and then put all of these modern pieces of furniture inside the castle and modern bathrooms. And they kept the giant wooden castle doors that were not functioning anymore. And they just put glass doors in front of them. They kept the stone and put, you know, it was just the way they did it was so well done and so well thought out of preserving the history and the architecture, which I love, and then making mm-hmm. it usable for modern day life. So, you know, if I hadn't traveled to this tiny town in the southern tip of Italy, I would have never seen this.
And have you in any way been able to sort of implement that in anything you're doing?
Well, it's funny because I was just talking to clients who have an older home that has some of those features and they are very modern. They are a young family. And so I was showing them, I took photos of it and how you can, you know, still have this sort of old world home and make it feel modern and young and hip for a modern family. So yeah, that particular example I have been able to use. But just seeing other, you know, I was in Milan in November and just seeing the Italian designers. I mean, the Italians do it well. They do it right. So they have a lot of brands there that we can't get in the US. So or that I would have to, you know, make a special trip to get. You can't just be, I mean, online we can do a lot, but you still can't do it all.
So what's next for you? Either things that you want to work on or things that you want to do with your business?
Yeah, I think for me, I've done in the last year 2 commercial projects, which I hadn't done before and I actually really enjoyed. So I'd love to do more of that. And, you know, I'd love to do, this is the first out of country project I've worked on in Grand Cayman. I've done sort of all over the US, but I've never done out of the country. So I think I'd like to do more of that. It's been really fun. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm toying with the idea of hiring a junior designer who can do some of the fabric, you know, she can at least narrow things down, run and get fabrics and do things like that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, you know, what I have in my mind's eye for the next phase.
So you're going to expand a little bit.
I would like to. Yeah, I would.
That's great.
Yeah.
And so if people want to look you up or get in touch mm-hmm. with you or mm-hmm. you know, see if it's a good match, if they can hire you to design their space, how do they get in touch with you? Where do they go? What do they do?
So I have a website. It's sarahrondesign.com. I am on Instagram. It's sarahrondesign. And you can email me, you can message me through Instagram. Mm-hmm. I respond to my messages. I've had people reach out to me through Instagram to hire me through my website. I also have an online presence at Howl's, but that's really small, but I do have that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, usually if you email me or reach out to me, you know, myself or Marcella will respond within 24 hours and you'll be getting a call from me.
Excellent. And so how far out in advance are you sort of, do people usually contact you for? Is it something like, oh, next year we're looking at doing this? Or is it stuff that's, you know, a couple of months mm-hmm. down the line? Or
I mean, I would say people who are a couple months down the line, and then also people who are like, we just bought a house. We want to renovate. Can you come tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And that's a lot. I met a woman last week who she's like, can you come today? I'm meeting with a realtor. We're closing on the house. Can you please come today? So, and it happened to be, you know, 5 minutes from where I live. So I did. I ran over there.
Lucky.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, normally I wouldn't be able to probably meet someone on the same day or even maybe the same week. But yeah, she lived 5 minutes away, or her new house is 5 minutes away. But yeah, I would say generally, you know, people who are looking to do a renovation a few months out, or people who have just bought a home and are going to renovate or are starting to build or starting to draw plans for a new build.
I think I actually saw you post something like that on Instagram where you said something like, it's not, you know, it's not a bad idea to actually bring your interior designer along with you, either when you are going to buy a house or you do buy a house, because I guess, you know, the insight that you might have into the home.
Exactly. Because they may think they can do things that they can't actually do, or there may be easy fixes for things that they think are bigger problems. You know, a lot of people don't have any idea of what things cost. So they may be thinking, oh, well, we can change this entire bathroom for, you know, $5,000. But in reality, it's probably going to cost $25,000. So I think having a designer there is really helpful.
Yeah.
And even when you're starting a new build, a lot of the builders, there are some, I work with amazing, wonderful builders who don't cut corners, but there are some who do. So if you have a designer with you when you're going through that process, it's sort of a backstop, right? The designer can ask the questions that, you know, the regular average person doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. Right. They can take advantage of your expertise and your...
Yes. I can't tell you how many clients I have that said like, oh my God, I wish I would have hired you sooner. You know, I have clients right now who hired me after the fact, but they had a contractor, you know, do some really terrible work in their backyard and charge them way too much for it. And if you have a designer, that's a person who can say, that shouldn't cost that much, and that's not done correctly. Right. So that's also a benefit of having a designer, for sure.
Well, Sarah, you have a fascinating story, and I look forward to maybe touching base in the future and seeing where you're at down the road.
Yes, would love to. Thank you again for having me.